A transgender ban stays in effect for now. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Supreme Court rules that the ban on transgender people in the military can stay in place, but opponents say they'll keep fighting.
I believe that this is a policy that the United States loses respect over around the world.
Also, Philippines President Duterte takes on the Catholic Church, and many in his Catholic-majority country love it.
Some people also feel he's gutsy, right? He's gutsy, saying things that even devout Catholics would have loved to say, and they just couldn't say it.
Plus, a rise in British anxiety over leaving the EU, but pro-Brexit voices are not wavering.
I don't believe in the soft Brexit, hard Brexit, anything. There's only a Brexit or no Brexit.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us this Tuesday. We begin with a ruling from the Supreme Court today. President Trump's ban on transgender people in the military can go into effect. The World's Roopa Shenoy is here to tell us more about it. What is the history here, Roopa?
If you'll remember, the president first announced this move on Twitter in July 2017, and then Defense Secretary Jim Mattis developed it into an actual policy. So it bans anyone who identifies with a sex other than what they had at birth. But there are exemptions. The ban doesn't affect transgender people already serving openly or people who are willing to serve in the sex assigned to them at birth. And the rationale behind this ban, the Trump administration has said, is that medical care for transgender soldiers is expensive and takes time from when they could be serving.
So when the ban was announced in July of 2017, I recall there were a lot of lawsuits.
Right. Lower courts have blocked the policy. But early this month, the administration had a win with a federal appeals court. It lifted an injunction. And then this morning, the Supreme Court issued an order that lifted all the injunctions. The vote was 5-4 with Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor and Kagan dissenting.
So what exactly does this ruling mean, Roopa? Can the administration start putting this policy into effect immediately?
Yes. I spoke to Sarah McBride. She's with Human Rights Campaign, and she happened to be the first transgender person to speak at a national political convention in 2016. She says this does give the administration the go-ahead, but other cases are still working their way through the courts and could still be taken up by the Supreme Court. So she calls this decision temporary.
The court today did not issue a ruling on the merits. It did not issue a ruling on the constitutionality. It did not issue a ruling as to whether the Trump transgender troop ban is illegal. It merely said as the courts decide these cases, the administration can begin implementing.
And what reaction have you heard, Roopa, to today's Supreme Court decision?
I asked Akira Wyatt to send me her thoughts. She's a transgender woman serving with the Navy stationed in California.
As a whole, we are greatly disappointed in today's ruling. However, as service members, we are trained to continue to do our jobs to the best of our ability, and we will stay the course as we serve our country with honor and dignity. We keep our heads high, and we keep up the fight.
Roopa, how many transgender people are there in the U.S. military?
In 2016, almost 9,000 members of the military identified as transgender.
What is the Pentagon saying today?
A Pentagon spokeswoman said in a statement that the military treats all transgender persons with dignity. And she said the proposed policy is not a ban. She says it's critical that the Defense Department be permitted to implement personnel policies that it determines are necessary to ensure the most lethal and combat effective fighting force in the world.
How does the U.S. policy compare to other countries on this?
It's still banned in some places like India, but Australia lifted its ban on transgender people in the military in 2010. The UK lifted theirs in 2000. Israel's policy has been to allow gay and transgender people in the military since 1993. Mm. And Sarah McBride of Human Rights Campaign, she says this move by the U.S. sends a message to the world.
It says that the United States is willing to sacrifice its national security in order to implement a hateful, discriminatory agenda. It says that our national government is intent on rolling back the clock on our progress when it comes to equality. I believe that this is a policy that the United States loses respect over around the world.
An important development today at the Supreme Court. The World's Roopa Shenoy. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Another note from the Supreme Court today, the justices took no action on a case focusing on the Trump administration's plan to end the DACA program. It shields hundreds of thousands of young, undocumented people from deportation. That non-action means the court won't be hearing the case until at least the fall. Meanwhile, the DACA program remains in effect. This is significant because President Trump had sought to insert DACA into some kind of deal to end the government shutdown. Now that looks less likely. Oh yeah, and we've reached day 32 of the shutdown. For some communities, including the border city of El Paso, Texas, the impact is adding up. Reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe spoke with several furloughed workers in El Paso. Monica, these furloughed workers, they were at a meeting with two members of the U.S. House of Representatives. What was that meeting like?
Yeah, so two freshman congresswomen, Veronica Escobar and Xochitl Torres Small, their districts are both along the U.S.-Mexico border in West Texas and southern New Mexico, respectively. They met with several federal worker union representatives and the head of the food bank in El Paso. The two congresswomen wanted to hear their concerns as the shutdown drags on for a fifth week now. Representative Escobar repeated some strong words she heard from a psychiatrist who works for the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
Please stop calling it a shutdown. The government's not shut down. We're all going to work. We're just not getting paid. If you want to shut the government down, shut her down. And let all of the prison guards go home for a day. Let all the TSA agents go home for a day, CBP, ICE, you name it. And then you'll feel what a shutdown is really like. That was so profound.
Veronica Escobar there, as well as Representative Torres Small. Are they both Democrats?
Yeah, so Escobar represents El Paso, a border city that has had the kind of steel fencing that the president wants to build for close to a decade now. While the fence has helped reduce crime and foot traffic in some neighborhoods, it still hasn't stopped migrant families from coming across. Most of these families aren't trying to evade Border Patrol agents. Instead, they walk right up to them. And within El Paso city limits, the steel fence is a short distance north of the actual border. So these migrants can walk onto U.S. soil before ever approaching the wall. So in that sense, it doesn't really serve as a deterrent.
And what did the furloughed federal workers have to say to these two lawmakers from Washington?
Well, I talked to union representatives from U.S. Customs and Border Protection. This is the agency that staffs the official ports of entry where millions of people cross into the U.S. from Mexico legally. They also inspect the commercial traffic coming across. And I should note, U.S.-Mexico trade is worth more than $500 billion annually. These officers are not only working without pay, they say they're working overtime several days in a row. There's been a longstanding shortage of customs officers, and their union says the shutdown only exacerbates an already bad situation. They tell me a batch of new recruits, for example, was set to start their training this year, but that was called off due to the shutdown, and these new recruits were sent home. The president talks about a wall stopping illegal drugs at the border, but the majority of those drugs are actually smuggled through these official ports of entry where these customs officers work.
Yeah, right. Or through the tunnels that we saw El Chapo's cartel build.
Yeah, these go underneath the ground, underneath any kind of fencing or barrier.
And it's not just federal workers, right, that are feeling the pain. You also spoke to a local food bank, which receives funding from the federal government.
Correct. The CEO of the El Paso Food Bank, her name is Susan Goodell. She says the food bank provides 35,000 meals for people in need daily. And a third of their food comes directly from the federal government. So does a quarter of their annual funding. The people they feed include both low-income seniors and children at 182 schools who rely on free breakfast and free lunch. All of this is at risk during the shutdown. Not only that, they've also begun to see federal workers show up at their doorstep.
Every food bank in this country is feeling the exact same pain. All of us are deeply concerned about where the food will come to supply the people already in need, but also the federal workers who are coming to our doors needing additional food.
Also, Goodell said some federal workers feel embarrassed about going to a food bank. And her message to them is, don't be. That's what they're there for.
That's reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe in El Paso telling us about the effects of the partial government shutdown at the U.S.-Mexico border. Monica, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'll tell you one group any barrier at the border won't stop. Millions of monarch butterflies crossing back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico each year. A much more serious challenge for these frequent flyers, a vanishing habitat. The monarchs depend on dense patches of evergreen forests in central Mexico to get through the winter. For several years now, those forests were getting decimated by logging and farming. Things have improved in recent years as the forests were protected and, in some cases, replanted. My BBC colleague Saskia Edwards went to meet one man in the Mexican state of Michoacán who did more than his share to help. His name is José Luis Álvarez.
My father lived in a small town which is called Colonia Juárez. In this beautiful valley, and above the valley is the forest, and there's a stream that goes through there. And I learned to hunt and swim and dive, and I fell in love with nature. I never thought it could be so damaged, you know. These mountainsides that they're at 8, 9, 10,000 feet that have these slopes, these tremendous slopes, and they're all just stripped bare of the forest, and they've made all these little tiny lots where they're trying to plant oats and corn. It looked like it had cancer, the forest. There was nothing left. I was anguished. Monarch, to overwinter, it needs a very dense forest, okay, to protect itself from the rain, from the sleet, and sometimes it even snows, okay? So the more trees they are, the more protected they are. The thinner it is, the easier it is when the weather changes for them to freeze to death. I'm going to show you some photographs where I'm knee-deep in butterflies.
Dead butterflies?
Yes.
So we're looking at this picture, and
those are butterflies.
So on the floor, it looks like you're knee-deep in, like, a foliage, like at autumn, that people have raked into a pile, but it's dead butterflies.
That's right. That was in 2002.
José Luis's idea was that he had to convince the locals to turn their farms into forest. He could grow the trees, but he knew the locals wouldn't pay for them.
So I decided I would start a nonprofit. I didn't know how to start a nonprofit.
If you can't tell already, José Luis has a way with words and can be very convincing. So that's how he convinced a guy from the US he met at breakfast one day to start an NGO for him. Then connections got him a spread in the New York Times.
And zap, I get 2 big donations. Just immediately. And that started it off. I convinced 3 people that had small lots to let me transform them into forests. It was difficult in the beginning because it had never been done on small plots.
There was more convincing to do. José Luis started going door to door, or farm to farm, asking locals if they would plant the trees he'd give them.
I planted 3 plots the first year. Second year I planted maybe 10 or 12. The next year, 40 or 50, and then I started going into the hundreds. And what happened is the neighbors who had just pieces of land, it was just dust and rocks, okay? They saw these trees flourish, and they said, I want to do the same thing.
Another convincing factor was the wood from the forests he was regenerating further away from the butterflies could be used sustainably for locals to make money, build furniture, and burn to heat their houses. It was so convincing.
I've had a lot of illegal loggers that now have commercial plantations on their land.
So how many trees has he planted?
In one particular year, I'll have funding to give away 1 million trees. Another year, I'll have funding for 700,000 trees. Another year, maybe 300,000 trees. But when you add up 23 years, it's millions. I don't know, 7, 8 million, I don't know, around there.
José Luis effectively helped plant an entire forest.
Saskia Edwards there with our partners at the BBC's Outlook program, telling us about José Luis Álvarez, who runs a tree nursery in the Mexican state of Michoacán and making life great for butterflies. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We've got plenty of government dysfunction here in the U.S., but Venezuela's level of dysfunction is something else entirely. The country's economy has pretty much collapsed. President Nicolas Maduro is at the start of his second term in office, but the head of Venezuela's opposition has made it clear he's prepared to take over instead. And tomorrow, there's a nationwide protest planned against Maduro. There are reports that yesterday, a group of Venezuelan National Guard troops tried to stage a revolt. We asked reporter Mariana Zuniga in Caracas to give us the latest.
A group of 27 National Guards, they were arrested by the government because they tried to turn against the government, tried to initiate some kind of coup, and now they were put in the order of the military justice. It shocked many people, but it's actually not the first time this has happened in Venezuela. In 2017, we saw maybe two or three.
Now, the leader of the opposition party, Juan Guaido, has been unusually bold in calling out Maduro. But until a week ago, a lot of people outside of Venezuela had not heard of him. What should we know about Juan Guaido?
Until a weekend ago, even inside Venezuela, not many people have heard about him. Right now, he's 35 years old. He's, if I'm not wrong, he's the youngest president that the parliament of Venezuela have had. He's kind of the new face of the opposition, and he kind of brought life to an opposition that seemed kind of dead. Many people haven't heard from the opposition since last year, and the political spectrum, the ball was in the court of the government, actually. And now they seem kind of rebirthing from the ashes with this nationwide protest that is expected tomorrow.
Juan Guaido is young. Is he kind of being seen as the energy needed for change?
I don't know if many people believe in him for being him or just because they needed someone to have hope that the situation could have an end, that the government of Maduro could have an end. Also, a particular thing that this young man is having is the support of the international community. Many head of states around Latin America, also in the European Union and in the United States, they don't recognize Maduro's government. They don't recognize this new term. So that has given power to this new wave of protest.
So with all this domestic and international pressure on Maduro, what's keeping his regime in place?
What's keeping his regime in place is what always kept him in place, the military. They've always counted the military as the major force inside their government, and that's something that has given them power. But now something is changing. Even the military, they are suffering the scarcity of food, the scarcity of medicines, the crippling hyperinflation, the cost of living. That's why this guy, Guaido, is also calling to the military to join them in the fight.
Well, I mean, the military is not really in a position to change the economic crisis, it seems. So is Maduro getting help from outside powers like Russia or China?
Some years ago, since the economic crisis started, they've been having some help from Russia and from China in economic terms. But the government of Venezuela is really in debt with these countries. And despite the fact that they are paying these debts, it doesn't seem plausible that these countries will keep lending money to the Venezuelan government in the future.
So there's going to be this big national protest tomorrow across Venezuela. Thousands of people are expected to take part. Do Venezuelans believe that after the national protest, things will change?
I don't know if things will change from tomorrow, but there's a certain feeling of hope in the street. Something that I haven't felt from people since 2017 when the other wave of protests took place. And even it feels different, maybe because people are more tired, maybe because other parts of the population seem to be joining the protests, people that have never joined before. Something is changing, and that's why we're seeing this kind of upheavals with this new movement.
Mariana Zuniga reporting there from Caracas. The 1-2 punch of political unrest and economic meltdown has hit millions of Venezuelans hard. That's why 3 million of them have fled the country in recent years, roughly 10% of the population. Thousands more follow every day. Many head to the border with Colombia and the city of Cúcuta. That's where we reach Marianne Menjivar today. She's the International Rescue Committee's country director in Colombia.
So today at the bridge, and I just came back from there, which is one of the three official crossing points, we've seen an increase in the people, the Venezuelan people that come into Colombia. People are saying there's national protest called for tomorrow in Venezuela, and people are scared of the repercussions stemming from the protest, and they've come to buy provisions, to buy food, and to buy essential items that they can't buy in Venezuela.
Does that suggest that they're going to return to Venezuela, or is their departure pretty much permanent at this point?
So the migrant crisis that's affecting the whole of South America is made up of three different types of refugees and migrants. On the one hand, you have what you call pendular migrants. And as the name suggests, they come and go. They cross into Colombia, buy essential items, and return to their homes in Venezuela. Then you have people who are leaving the country permanently to settle in Colombia or in neighboring countries. And you have a third type, the people that don't have the official documentation or the money, and they start walking across Colombia in order to settle in different cities and also in other countries.
So, Marianne, when you say the number of Venezuelan refugees has gone up, are you talking about all three groups?
Normally, you would see at the Simon Bolivar Bridge 35 to 40,000 Venezuelans crossing on a daily basis.
Wow.
Now you've got a number that's going up according to eyewitnesses, according to the people coming in and out, and the immigration officials.
When Venezuelans arrive in Colombia, what are they most in need of?
What Venezuelans will tell you is that they want jobs. They want employment. They don't want charity. They want to be able to provide for their families here and for their families left behind back in Venezuela. And they're hardworking, and they want to be able to have the opportunity to make a new life for themselves.
This one port of entry in Cúcuta, I mean, you said 35 to 40,000 people a day. I mean, that was when it was at a lower point of people crossing. How has all this affected Colombia? How are people reacting to the migrants?
So the Colombian government, I think, has been an example to, you know, the international community and the world about how government should respond to this crisis. They're keeping the borders open. They keep coming up with different mechanisms to make sure that Venezuelans have the proper documentation and status that will enable them to make a life for themselves here. It's very unfortunate that the international community hasn't mobilized the level of resources this crisis needs. So the biggest response is coming from Colombians, civil society, the churches, NGOs. We're doing everything we can with very limited resources. And the Colombian government is providing a very open legal framework to let Venezuelan migrants come through to Colombia and go on to other neighboring countries if that's their wish.
Marianne Menjivar, she is the country director in Colombia for the International Rescue Committee, speaking with us from Cúcuta in the north of Colombia. Marianne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. Every year, wealthy and powerful people gather in Davos, Switzerland, to try and figure out the economic future of the planet. That's how they see it. Critics call it something else.
A family reunion for the plutocratic elite that broke the world.
Two views on Davos and the always changing economic world order. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's that time of the year, Davos, the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, where the wealthy and the powerful gather to figure out the future of the planet. Even when Davos doesn't host the World Economic Forum, it's still, safe to say, a destination for the rich.
Davos is a municipality in the canton of Graubünden in Switzerland. It is the highest town in Europe and the home of one of Switzerland's biggest ski resorts, with six main ski areas totaling 320 kilometers of slopes.
Joining me now is The World's Jason Margolis, who covers the economy for us. Global business leaders, politicians, economists are all meeting in Switzerland this week, Jason. What are their main concerns?
Well, first of all, Davos sounds pretty nice.
Not bad.
Yeah, they're not bad. The main concerns are a slowing world economy, namely China. China is growing at a rate of 6.6% annually, which sounds great, but it's the slowest rate of growth since 1990. So the question is, why is it slowing? Well, there is less consumer demand for products in China. Also, the trade war between President Trump and China is having an impact.
Right. And so that's a concern because China is so muscular, economically speaking. What else are they talking about in Davos?
They're talking about globalization and the backlash against globalization. So the people in Davos, they believe that more trade promotes healthier, freer societies. And a major theme is what they're calling globalization 4.0. And that's kind of a buzzword. But essentially, how does the world cope in the era of digitization where data is moving across countries and not just goods? And they're tackling some really interesting themes. I was looking at their website. So some of the themes are, how do we save the planet without killing growth? So environmental topics. Can you be a patriot and a global citizen? How do we make sure technology makes life better and not worse? So pretty interesting topics, I think.
Yeah, some difficult questions too there. Jason, Davos has been criticized for being a playground for the wealthy, but there have been some notable achievements there in the past.
Right. They tackle a lot of economic and social issues, and it's a neutral place where people can get together and talk about issues. Greece and Turkey averted a war there in the 1990s. Yasser Arafat and Shimon Peres met there in 1994, laying the groundwork for further talks.
Yeah, so it can be constructive. Is there anything notable happening there this week?
Well, I think what's really notable is who is not there. Last year, President Trump spoke in Davos. He is not there. The leaders of France, the UK, India, Canada, they're all not there.
And why do you think they didn't show up this year?
Well, the speculation is twofold. One, they're dealing with crises back home. And secondly, the optics. It looks bad when you have these problems in your country and you're going off to this ski village in Switzerland for a week and it's very expensive. In Trump's absence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke via telecast. And remember, Davos is a forum that embraces globalization. So let's listen to Pompeo here.
Nations matter. No international body can stand up for a people as well as their own leaders can. Strong borders are key to strong nations. This is how we keep our people safe and protect our sovereignty.
So it's kind of an anti-globalization sentiment. Now, in his defense, he did support a lot of these international bodies that the U.S. is part of, but he said they need reforming and that nations need to be doing more and paying their fair share, which is a very Trumpian thing to say.
The World's Jason Margolis. Thanks for this.
Thanks, Marco.
Michael Klein is an economist at Tufts University and founder and executive editor of EconoFact.org. Michael, what does Davos represent to you?
Well, Davos is a meeting of the elites, although that's a rather vague term, where I think, you know, people honestly would like to do better for the world. There's probably some self-interest involved as well. But there are a lot of problems that transcend national borders. And I think one of the things that people are trying to do there is to think about those. So, for example, if you think about disease, the AIDS epidemic, malaria in Africa, things like that, those are some of the things that people there have talked about. And there are clearly lots of challenges that we're facing. So this is one perspective, only one, but it's one perspective that then gets a lot of attention.
Let me get another perspective from Anand Giridharadas. He's the author of Winners Take All, A Critique of the Global Elite. Anand is in New York. What does Davos represent to you?
A family reunion for the plutocratic elite that broke the world. To me, it's extraordinary. I mean, I have called for this to be the final Davos. I think there are other forums or other types of forums for international cooperation for the reasons just mentioned that we could imagine. But this particular one is not a general forum of all kinds of people around the world. It is a meeting of plutocratic business people. I think half or more are business people who pay enormous amounts of money to be there. And then the other half are kind of handpicked and often relatively safer members of civil society, journalists, and others. But this is a group of people who have been consistently meeting over the years for decades now, talking about how they're going to make the world a better place. Yet more and more data seems to suggest, and I think many of your listeners would understand from their own lives, that in this very era in which the plutocratic elite in the United States and elsewhere has been talking about making the world a better place and coming together to solve problems, it is they who have actually been monopolizing the fruits of the future. 82% of new wealth generated in 2017 went to the global top 1%. So we're living in this moment which the very people who've caused so many people to feel alienated, angry, like they can't make lives in the societies that they live in, these people are getting together to celebrate themselves in Davos. And frankly, they are the problem, not the solution.
Well, I suspect you would say that ending Davos would not end global inequality. Michael Klein, do you see a global system in need of fundamental change?
Well, certainly there are a lot of challenges in the world. Inequality is one of them. But, you know, while that's true, we also have to think of the fact that over the last generation and a half or so, 800 million people have been raised out of poverty. And child mortality has gone, infant mortality has gone down, life expectancy has gone up. And I'm not sure that, you know, as much high profile as Davos gets, I'm not sure that that's really steering where the world is going. There are clearly a lot of problems, like in the United States, with issues of Citizens United and dark money in campaigns. I wouldn't necessarily put Davos in the same box as Citizens United.
I mean, there has been significant change, Anand Giridharadas. There is still a lot of inequality, as I know you see it. But there are a lot of people who now have running water in toilets that didn't have them 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, people always bring that up. And I got to say, I was there. I was there. I was a foreign correspondent for The New York Times in India in the period when that was happening in the 2000s. And it's a remarkable story. But I think, you know, what is the lesson of it? Well, the reality is India and China got out of their own way in the 80s and the 90s and moved away from failed social experiments. So my only argument is that, yeah, that reduction is terrific. But in that same period, does anybody doubt that here in the United States, we are moving closer and closer if we're not already in oligarchic levels of inequality? Does anybody doubt that Britain and many other Western European countries are in that same situation? I mean,
Do you doubt that?
Well, certainly, you know, there's a lot of evidence that inequality is rising. The question is, what is the source of that? And I think that there are a lot of government failures. Why are those arising? So, Anand, I guess you would suggest that it has to do with the power of lobbying. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. But, you know, to paint all elites as the same, there's several aspects of that. One is that it could very well be that some of what they're doing is self-serving. But I wouldn't put, like, you know, the Koch brothers and those billionaires who are trying to promote greater environmentalism in the same box. I think that's much too broad a paintbrush that you're using for that.
Anand, last question for you, what you were just sketching out a moment ago. What would it take for all that to happen? Do you see some kind of like French Revolution part deux?
I hope this doesn't have to go the way of the French Revolution. I mean, look, I once read in a book that history is full of the story of distributions of power that seem totally reasonable until one day they seem insane. Throughout history, you think of the feudal era giving way to a more democratic era. You think about an era in which, you know, very few people questioned why women couldn't vote, to an era in which it was soon unthinkable that women couldn't vote. You think about segregation being normal to people and then suddenly it was not normal. You think about the progress we've made on LGBT rights. The reality is we have lived for about 30, 40 years in an era defined by a veneration of markets and a kind of supremacy of capital. And history has kind of swings. And I think that's been an extreme tendency in our age. And when I see a lot of the movement around the world, when I talk to people in Britain, where I was last week, when I talk to people in this country, where I do most of my reporting, I think most people, most average people, I think some of us in more pointy-headed spaces and in the media are sometimes the last to know. Most regular people I meet out there in the country, in Ohio and Iowa and elsewhere, are fully aware of the fact that the way they've been working, the way their bosses have been treating them, the way that this country has been failing to translate innovation into progress in their lives, something is due to change.
Anand Giridharadas, the author of Winners Take All. Also, Michael Klein, an economist at Tufts University and founder and executive editor of Econofact.org. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte delights in shock value. He's boasted about slaughtering drug addicts and has compared himself to Hitler. He's told Barack Obama and UN officials to go to hell. The dubious achievements go on, but these days Duterte is stepping up attacks on a group that was long considered untouchable in the Philippines, the Catholic Church. Here's the world's Patrick Nguyen.
If you want to commit political suicide in the Philippines, you might say something like this.
Is there any bishop here? I want to kick your ass. I tell you, the most hypocritical institution in the Philippines is the Catholic Church.
That is President Duterte talking about beating up bishops and priests in one of the most devoutly Catholic nations on earth. And this is not even the most provocative thing he's been saying about priests.
Most of the priests there are homosexuals, almost 90% of you.
This "most priests are gay" line, he always says this during his rants about sexual predators, conflating being gay with preying on kids. It's one of his go-to lines. In the Philippines, the people, the government, the culture, they're all intertwined with Catholicism. 80% of the population is Catholic. So How does Duterte get away with this?
Duterte is just a completely unprecedented species.
Richard Heydarian is an academic who wrote a book called The Rise of Duterte.
You know, people like Duterte are disruptors. So the same kind of rules of the game that were applied to his predecessor is no longer applied to him because he changed the game itself.
There are several forces at play here. One is that Duterte's war on drugs has killed, by some estimates, 20,000 people. An influential priest keep telling him this is immoral and corrupt. Duterte hates this. He recently told one bishop that he'd have his head cut off. Duterte's take is, you, Catholic priest, lecturing me about morality and corruption?
What have you done except to collect money from the people? And that corruption dates back to many, 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 many years ago.
Here he's playing on the church's legacy of tyranny. You know, all that brutality inflicted by Christopher Columbus on behalf of the Spanish Empire. Slavery, indoctrination, mass killing. Well, Spain and the Vatican later brought all of that to the Philippines, a series of islands named after a Spanish king, Philip, who thought European Catholics were just superior to so-called natives.
We were considered natives, and sometimes pictured as apes.
That was a very long time ago. But today, the church keeps up its crusades, like fighting to keep divorce illegal, or saying that women on birth control pills are like murderers, pushing this agenda that just isn't that popular with most Filipinos, including Duterte. Also, Heydarian says everyone in the Philippines knows this is personal for Duterte. He has said that he was molested as a boy by an American priest.
People also know that this is coming from an experience of anger and trauma. So I think that is also where he gets actually sympathy.
And Heydarian says a lot of Filipinos realize that Duterte exaggerates things, that he throws wild bombshells in the middle of his long rambling speeches just to get the crowd fired up.
I notice he also does that sometimes because he feels like the audience is bored. And this is where he's kind of Trumpish. He knows the audience is looking also for a bombshell and he gives it to them.
This is classic Duterte. Like with Trump or Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, their fans love watching them freak out the established order.
Some people also feel he's gutsy, right? He's gutsy, saying things that even devout Catholics would have loved to say and they just couldn't say. Because there are some people who feel that Duterte is a necessary rude shock to push the Catholic Church to get their own house in order.
Now, there is one red line that Duterte does not want to cross. He would like you to know that despite his hatred for priests, he is not an atheist.
I never said I do not believe in God. Kindly revisit my statement. I said your God is stupid. My God has a lot of common sense. Those were the exact words.
Once again, these words don't get him in much trouble. His approval rating just went up to more than 80%. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
If I were a lawmaker in Britain right now and I looked at the calendar, I'd be seriously nervous. The UK has not come up with a plan for its exit from the European Union, and the deadline is March 29th. Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit proposal was shot down big time by Parliament last week. Lawmakers are due to vote next week on May's Plan B. Luckily, we have our BBC colleague Rob Watson here to help us sort through all this. This is like the worst reality show ever, but you can't change the channel, Rob. What do we know about Theresa May's Plan B?
Well, so unlike some reality shows, politicians don't get to be force-fed hideous things to eat on an island or do other wretched things.
Would you like to see that at this point?
Well, I suspect that an awful lot of British voters would love to see them experience some pain. But anyway, to get on and answer your question, Marco.
The Plan B.
The interesting thing is that Plan B is absolutely indistinguishable from Plan A. I'm not sure if when you were younger, you remember in the newspapers, they used to have those spot the difference. You'd
right.
have two photos
yeah.
and there'd be teeny tiny differences. I don't think there are even any of those in this. So
wow.
I think it's fair to say that Theresa May is, I mean, I think her strategy is to basically see the clock run down towards Brexit and hope that despite that rejection of historic proportions last week, eventually MPs, politicians, will be so utterly terrified of Britain leaving the EU without any kind of a deal at all, or for some people just not leaving, that they will eventually get behind it.
And is that what we're going to be seeing on March 29th?
Look, it's the absolute key question. Will the majority of politicians in Theresa May's governing Conservative Party get behind the deal, even though they don't like it at the last minute? I mean, we simply don't know. I mean, it seems to me that that is entirely what Theresa May is banking on. I guess the question is, what happens if they don't?
Well, I understand the whole ordeal has been giving MPs opportunities to propose alternatives to May's plan B. Are there two or three ideas that seem to be gaining some traction or getting some backing?
So there are two things going on. I guess one is a sort of procedural kind of mechanistic type of thing, and that is a bunch of MPs from across the parties saying, you know what, Britain leaving without a deal is utterly, completely crazy. That would trash the economy. And so they want to get a mechanism in place whereby politicians outside of the government could force the government not to go ahead with a no-deal Brexit. And this is just so weird. Nothing like this has been tried in British politics. So whether it can work, whether it's a good idea, a bad idea, constitutional violation, who knows? The other thing that other MPs are doing is saying, OK, so we don't like Theresa May's deal. Let's maybe explore the alternatives. And here, I think, Marco, is one of the things that Theresa May has got going for her. This is going to sound a bit odd, so bear with me a tick.
OK.
And that is, even though the majority of MPs obviously gave her deal a right thumping, it's not clear that they could agree on anything else. I mean, in many ways, that is the sort of, you know, that's at the bottom of Britain's biggest crisis since the end of the Second World War, that the majority of MPs still can't agree on what to do about the result of the referendum.
I know we've talked about this before, but is another Brexit referendum on the table? I mean, putting the question of whether the UK should exit the EU before the people again, like in 2016.
I mean, I would only say it's more likely than it was a year ago, in the sense that the stalemate among the politicians is so profound. I don't think we're there yet, but could we get closer to that? Possibly.
My BBC colleague Rob Watson speaking with us from London. Thanks as always, Rob.
Thank you, Marco.
Not sure this whole Brexit debate impacts you or why Britain would want to leave the EU? Well, A, head over to theworld.org for 5 reasons why Americans ought to care about Brexit, and B, let's hear a point of view we haven't heard much on the show lately, someone who absolutely wants to leave the EU. Rebecca Ryan started a pro-Brexit Twitter campaign from her living room in Kent, and she got 51 lawmakers to take her Stand Up for Brexit pledge. I asked Rebecca why she's devoted so much of her time to Brexit.
I just believe in the principles of democracy and fairness. I think the reaction from the mainstream media and from sort of noisy London-centric Remain voters the morning after the result was announced was immediate. There was an immediate sort of alarmist response telling Brexiteers that they were racist, that they were thick, that they were old, and that they all lived up in the north. I mean, it's actually not only inaccurate, but it's actually deeply insulting. And I think it's the injustice of that which is part of the motivation.
Do you believe the UK should leave the EU, even if there's no deal? Like, do you favour a hard Brexit?
I believe that certainly the outcome of the referendum should be honoured. I don't believe in the soft Brexit, hard Brexit, anything. There's only a Brexit or no Brexit. Now, the point of this is that what's on the table at the moment is not actually the deal. This is the withdrawal agreement. And, you know, if the withdrawal agreement is such that it's trying to tie the UK to the EU indefinitely, then absolutely, then we should leave without such a withdrawal agreement. And it's not a case of crashing out or cliff edge, all of that kind of thing, because all of these contingency plans have been put in place. Our civil service has been working very hard, but it's been in the government's benefit to not let the EU know about that, to not disclose fully the preparations that they've been doing. So there's no such thing anymore as no deal Brexit. There is managed no deal, and that management and that mitigation is already underway and in place. But in the meantime, the hand of friendship is still extended to the EU, and they can come back and we can talk about doing the free trade agreement that Donald Tusk offered back in only October last year.
So, Rebecca, as someone who wants to be out of the EU, are there any benefits of being in the EU that you're going to miss when Brexit finally happens?
I can't say so. I mean, all of the things that you can do, go and visit any of your neighbouring countries that you like to go and visit, will still be there. I don't see, no, for me, no.
Freedom of labor movement into the UK? I mean, that's not an issue.
No, I mean, this is the thing about sovereignty, is that we'll be able to dictate exactly what labor movement we want. So we can say, you know, actually, we don't want cheap labor to come in because we don't want our wages being artificially suppressed. But actually, yes, we do need doctors or nurses or whatever it is that the government decides that they need. And we can dictate that policy.
What would you say to another Brexit referendum, or maybe a referendum that would let people choose between Theresa May's current plan, a hard Brexit, or no Brexit?
I think the second referendum is not a good idea at all. I think, you know, we've already had one and it needs to be enacted. And if you don't enact a referendum, then you're undermining your democracy as a whole, because why would the voting public ever trust what the lawmakers have said to them again? So no, we were told that it would be a once-in-a-generation vote, and that's what it should be.
Rebecca Ryan speaking with us from Kent, as she's the founder of Stand Up for Brexit. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
That is where we leave you today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.